Chapter 7. Instruct the child once only for better attention and compliance. Many years ago, a father, accompanied by his son, visited me for a professional advice. He introduced himself as a landlord. The son appeared to be in his late 20s. On the conclusion of satisfactory consultation, the father turned directly to the son and instructed him what to do in the matter. The father chose to give the instruction in my presence, perhaps to ensure that it was correctly articulated as discussed. However, as if the articulation was not assuring enough and the time already taken was not long enough, the father repeated the instruction. This time he repeated also some words, the planned timing, and the names and places concerned in the contents of the instruction over and over again, much to my concealed disgust and to the visible boredom of the son. Now, I got the clue why the son was not so attentive to the instruction at the first time. It was obviously because he was well trained since childhood to wait for a repetition of every instruction given. And yet one more clue. The father had also kept on repeating to me his questions to prompt me into repeating my answers during the discussion. It was obvious that he too was made a victim of this family trait in his childhood, and he was dutifully passing it on to his son. Mental hazard. The indications were that the repetition of the instruction in my office was not going to be last one from the father to the son. The full sympathy is for the wife, the work subordinates or the employees and the house servants of such a person, because this type of a chain of onslaught of boredom can be a mental hazard and therefore, a cause for parting ways. With the complexities of the present life as we know of, let us be conscious of the dictum that, time has become a precious commodity, making and retaining friends an art, and to be counted as being among the persons with a polished or refined personality a challenge. Nothing is more unnerving than listening to a same piece of information, advice or instruction repetitively at the same moment. It goes against the dictum. For any errand or assignment, have the habit of saying your instruction once only to the child and surprise yourself with the results. Your instruction wins his sharp attention and a secured place in his memory for a perfect compliance because it was said once, as always. He too will adopt and pass on this polished culture down in the family. Another dimension. However, there is also another dimension to this unpleasant weakness. The child who has been made habituated to responding only after a repeated instruction is likely to grow up as an adult with yet a greater weakness. While he would show immediate willingness to do a favor upon a request, he would act only after the request has been repeated, even if the favor was small or simple. There are those amongst us who express a request only once for a favor. Repeating the request is avoided because it amounts to begging. A person makes an inconsiderate spouse in the family, also an unkind son or a daughter to the aged parents, if the person habitually needs a repetition of almost every small request before he would remember to oblige. Often the repetition awaited never appears and the request drifts from the memory as if it never existed. The favor is deemed to have been denied when the intention was not so. Chapter 8. The child's first attendance in a mosque. There always comes a time when a child is seen old enough to be taken for the first time to a mosque. He has some knowledge of taharat, cleanliness, and ehtiram, respect, for the mosque. Incidentally, that is also the age when the child can be allowed the benefit of his first impression to be his lasting one with regard to his first experiences that he comes across in his life and the values attached to them. Parents need to believe and make the child also believe that his first participation in a congregational prayer is a momentous occasion for him and for the family, which indeed is, if only they knew. The first impact and impression of the child regarding the occasion will leave lasting imprints in his memory. A person belongs to where his memories are. Some childhood memories always survive sharply to create the desire to relive the occasions. And he later in his adult life relives the occasion like this subconsciously by maintaining regularity in the attendance of daily prayers. Planning and preparation. But this has to be preceded by an enthusiastic planning, an ostentatious preparation for the child to notice. So the child's inquisitive nature makes him attentive to the talk going on around him about certain prior arrangements and time schedules, and he knows in his own small way that there is in the air an important occasion out. His interest, however, sharpens with great expectations when he hears the debate whether he is old enough for his first participation and, if he is, what smart clothes he can put on. The child's first attendance inside a mosque should be planned as a big favor from the parents and accorded an appropriate ostentation and importance. To register a maximum importance of the occasion on the child, the day fixed is later than earlier to plunge him into a longer duration of raised expectations, so that he has also time to raise the subject of the anticipated big day in the family and reveal it in confidence to the neighbor's children. Self-identity. The plan should provide for an early arrival at the mosque to enable the child, in his new suitable dress for the occasion, to be taken round for the inspection of the facilities and general familiarization so that he begins to feel at home. He is introduced to relatives and family friends in the mosque before and to some after the congregational prayer, and later to the imam of the congregation also. The introduction is by his name to accord him a self-identity and acknowledge his distinct personality. What is needed to be avoided, however, is the regimental warning of do's and don'ts while in the mosque or pointing out to the child his mistakes in observing the discipline of the congregational prayer, and more importantly, avoiding the day when there is a sermon and lengthy proceedings. Children cannot maintain concentration longer at a stretch. Spells of boredom are counterproductive. The first participation in the mosque serves only as a maiden experience to sink in and not as a start for a regular attendance. The subsequent attendance should be at intervals, preferably at the child's own request, to be followed by an incentive like a visit to a candy shop or an ice cream parlor before returning home. The child, when adult and himself a parent, will cherish the memory of such first experience and think very kindly of his parents when they are deceased. The parents and the mosque become linked for a center place in the memory. He cannot belong to the parents when they are no more in this world, but he belongs to the euphoric memories in which they feature. In a good Muslim family, a child's best and lingering memories are of the parents taking pain to teach him the obligations in Islam. Chapter 9. Introduce the child to the clock. An office messenger who was sent to collect some important papers was asked to come back for them precisely in 20 minutes because of the urgency. When he came back in 10 minutes instead, he was asked to return once again in 10 minutes. He reappeared much later. He should have been given the exact time. It would have been easy for him to keep a track of it by consulting those who kept a wristwatch. He never kept one, and therefore he had never gained a dependable sense of the passage of time, even if it were for a small span of 5 minutes. When the messenger is idle and anxiously waiting for a due time for an assignment, the due time arrives faster, and when he is busy with another interim job in the meantime, the due time arrives later for the assignment. If the exact known time due is in 15 minutes, he would still ask people for time information or go to consult the clock about 3 times. There can be no efficient management of the daily affairs and no trust earned in the society without a diligent adherence to a time management, and the time management is elusive without mastering the sense and value of time. Islam also teaches a meticulous observance of time which has disciplinary variables. That was with regard to the earthly clock. Graphic and vivid. A man of about 80 years of age, in the course of a normal talk, was narrating to his son during one leisurely weekend a family event which had taken place when he was in his 20s and his own father was the head of the family. His narration to the end was graphic and vivid, and his face expression lively, as if there was a reenactment of the event before his eyes. Then, strangely, after remaining quiet and thoughtful for some time, the aged person rose from his seat, stood still thoughtful, and then slowly walked away to retire in his room. It should be easy to guess why the old man suddenly fell into a deep thought with all the visible sign of desolation and melancholy. He felt that the event had taken place only yesterday, and there he was an old person today, and the relatives will argue at the cemetery tomorrow whether that old weather-beaten grave was indeed his. the span of some 60 years, since the event was now a mere 24 hours to him. And that is precisely what the Holy Quran wants us to remember. He will say, "How many years did you tarry in the earth?" They will say, "We tarried a day or part of a day," but ask those who keep account. He will say, "You did tarry but a little had you but known it." Now this is the celestial heavenly clock, time will tell. Introduce the child to the earthly time clock in time so that he later as an adult becomes aware of the celestial clock also in time and is not caught by a rude shock like the old man. What a great pity when there are people in the society who were raised and conditioned to be oblivious to the dictates of both the clocks. Sense and value of time. Observe our children. They think of a number of things to do in a day, more on a holiday, but when asked, they will be seen having no idea at all of the respective time normally necessary for each of them. The things are just too many for a day even if sleep is skipped. It means that the parents have not yet introduced them to the clock. Children must grow up as adults with a smart sense and value of time. If the child says that he was going to a certain shop to buy a book, ask him as if for a mere interest to know how long that will take him until he returns home. He will begin to think, estimate perhaps wrongly, and then reply. That is a good start if such casual inquiries are made as a normal practice. When the child mentions a duration of time for a particular job or assignment, challenge him that it will take him longer, to make him conscious of the time. He will try to accomplish it much sooner with an eye on the clock, not only to meet the challenger but also to impress. If the child invites friends at home for a small afternoon party, ask him when will it be over and then teasingly question, "Why so late?" Not because it matters whether late or not. He will immediately direct his mind to the time management to explain and justify why so late, though to the parents it may not be late. All these are a part of the exercise and practice of time orientation to teach the child time management through a cultivation of a sharp sense and value of time. This is essential. Parents should also impress the child, when grown up as a youth, that only yesterday they were young like him and tomorrow he will be old like them. As an adult, the child will always know that time is constantly slipping by fast beyond his control according to the earthly clock, and death is always the same day according to the celestial heavenly clock, even if it were 40 or 60 years hence. Chapter 10. The child with culture of reading is more visionary. An anxious husband away from home reads quickly important pieces of news from the letter he has just received from his family and then reads them all over again. If the anxious husband had been illiterate, he would have got the letter read out to him by someone who would have then folded and returned it to him, only to see him unfolding the letter and looking intently into it as if he was now able to read it. The action in both cases reveals a particular pattern of the human mind. It wants to register and familiarize the pieces of news at its own independent pace. If the husband is reading about his baby being sick, his mind is also registering a likely perception, familiar to his mind, of the background against which the baby is in the state of sickness. The pace for reading is influenced by the pace at which each piece of the news undergoes such a mental registration in a wider perspective. The mind works the same natural way for an illiterate person too. Unfolding the letter only to be looking into it is to prompt a mental registration of the picture depicted from the news which is in the letter. The only disadvantage is that when a letter is read out, the pace at which he hears may not be the leisurely he would like if he were reading the letter himself for an efficient registration. His mind is always alert about what is next to be heard, and this disturbs the efficiency pace of registration. He therefore takes the letter to someone else for a favor of being read out to him again, though he now knows mostly what is next in the line of hearing. The difference. This is precisely the difference also when a person listens to a program of a series of national and international news in a quick succession from radio or TV channels and when he reads them in the newspapers. The latter facilitates a mental treatment of each piece in a wider perspective at an acceptable pace, and this helps in avoiding the absorption of any hidden message planted behind the presentation of the S by the electronic media. The electronic media, therefore, has an effective capability as compared to the print media of manipulating the public opinion in this way. No wonder that the electronic media has captured a wider market and is capable of influencing large segments of public on the issues of faith, religion, socio-culture, politics, economy and such others, because it conveniently saves those gullible among the public viewers from exercise of smart thinking and scrutiny. Fertile mind. As a result, more and more among the succeeding generations lose the culture of serious-minding reading. Gone are the days when a child was seen in his room engrossed in lingering a book and weighing or questioning mentally the merits of the thoughts and s of the author. It is this process which helped the child to widen the horizon of his critic mind, and it is such a child who grew up able to also develop a creative mind, formulate his own ideas and then be able to write or express them. He possessed a fertile mind of originality and creativeness because he had conditioned the mind into a critical thinking while feeding it regularly with a serious reading. He grew better equipped to formulate his independent thoughts and visions and to advise lead. The mind in a child wants to explode into an expansive horizon, such is the thirst for absorption of knowledge and information, and he can draw on a number of sources to satisfy this, the sources being family, school, electronic media, friends, etc. The source is, however, reading, which means a flow of one's own critic thoughts as he continues to read. While there is always plenty of reading around in the school, places of business and work, etc., none of these can serve as a substitute for the taste and culture of the leisurely at home or in a library for the reasons explained above. Message is simple. The message is simple and yet crucial. Do not let your child grow up without having cultivated the habit of reading as a family culture or hobby. A certain time is set during a weekend and school holidays when the child is alone in his room with arrangement of no access to TV, radio, computer, game or telephone chat, and he picks up a suitable children book to kill the initial boredom, preferably one of those with a good moral story or fiction and an attraction to complete it. Some parents may perceive this arrangement as an unnecessary toll on their dear child for such an apparently minor habit. It is probable that they themselves lack or underrate the culture of reading and any idea of its richness in the mental nourishment. Reading is a culture with no compensatory substitute, and no culture is minor. Chapter 11. The Child and His Concept of Allah. Talking about a small child's initial concept of Allah, one person was reminiscing his childhood's misconcept. A member in the family died. His father had an explanation: someone called Allah took him away. This information created a fear in him of whoever takes people away. Incidentally, whenever he misbehaved in the street while walking along with his mother, she would point out at a police constable if one happened to be in sight and scare him, she would ask the constable to take him away. So during his early childhood he, in his misplaced concept, likened Allah when mentioned at home, to a man in a khaki uniform. As Allah is not visible and yet he is often mentioned at home, children form their own independent picture of him in their mind. It varies from child to child. Such pictures are influenced mostly by what the parents mention about Allah's pleasure and displeasure in the context of a child's misbehavior and his sinning against him because of the misbehavior. Such incidental and cursory introduction of Allah with the depiction of human emotions in him gives a misleading representation of his attributes. For example, the mention of Allah as punishing for a wrongdoing makes a child liken him to a teacher he knows in the neighborhood who punishes students in the school. And yet, the mention of Allah being wise and all the time alive gives to another child the picture of an old and knowledgeable grandfather who is getting older and yet keeps on living. Polishing or polluting. Everyone is born with a natural inborn belief that there exists power and control over himself by his creator, Aliman Bil Ghaib, belief in the unseen, and this nagging belief is general for the mankind. The human mind cannot remain blank or shed this belief. He has either to run the path to polishing the belief or run the risk of polluting it. There is no third option. In the case of a child, therefore, under the inspiration of this inborn belief, he senses a thirst for information in order to polish the belief. In the absence of adequate and balanced information, his imaginative mind tries to fill in the gaps and comes up with an incorrect interim concept of his creator, who he finds often mentioned as Allah in the family. This misconcept is common with small children. Therefore, it is an Islamic obligation of the parents to ensure that as the child grows up, his thirst, which often goes unknown to them, is quenched amply with a flow of pure and proper information. The risk of the child drawing information from other doubtful sources, as an alternative, becomes diminished. He is spared from his belief being tampered with doubts later in his adult life. Religious duty. The parents therefore have a religious duty to ensure that the child is purposefully engaged in the proper learning of correct and balanced concept of Allah as early as possible, essentially based on his attributes. The perfect concept of his being and existence is, however, beyond human comprehension. The initial childhood picture of Allah as a being with a human physique, image, emotions, needs or limitations must not stay on longer. And this is only possible when the entire package of his attributes, including those of his benevolence, compassion, forgiveness, generosity and such others, are addressed. There therefore develops a balanced concept of him as the loving and lovable being, and yet also a reasonably feared one if disobeyed or angered, all in the context of Tawhid, absolute oneness. Common God is not Allah. What is even more important is to impress upon the child that there exists only Allah and there is no God besides him, and that the mention by others of God or God, who lacks all the combined attributes of Allah, is not Allah. And no God other than Allah exists. Therefore, the universally common God worshipped by all others does not exist if he is not Allah. While it is true that great sawab is earned by those parents who are the first to teach their children to recite or read the verse, Bismillahirrahmanirrahim, its importance is not confined to teaching the recitation of the verse or its translation only. The importance essentially lies also in helping the children to form a correct and balanced Islamic concept of Allah mentioned in the verse. It has to be reiterated that Allah has created man in the nature of wanting to know him. Human reasoning, which is attuned to his nature, leads to knowing him rightly. Therefore, children's ability to reason, when prodded by the parents, to gain the right concept of Allah should not be underrated. When the growing child is taught to address his dua, supplication, to Allah, the impact of his faith in the dua is tremendous only if he has also been made to gain the right Islamic concept of him. Chapter 12. The culture of talking to Allah. If rooted deeply and practiced earnestly during one's lifetime, this culture can make a difference in one's fate in this and the next world. But then it needs to be commenced and cultivated in one's childhood. It is not common to see a child moved on his own accord to talking to Allah in the form of dua, supplication. It never dawns upon the children the need to talk to Allah. Their parents make available for them almost all that they need, desire or hope for. They provide a dependable sense of security. When children fall sick, they see the parents bring medicine to make them feel well again. There was, however, this child who did talk to Allah. No one in the family had asked him to. Though his mother, half crying, was telling his grandmother on the phone that his baby sister, with signs of a serious dehydration, was to be rushed to the hospital that very moment. The baby was in danger of her life, and the family doctor who had just left after examining her would join them after a short while. She ended the conversation hurriedly with a frantic plea to the grandmother for a dua to Allah. After the parents had left with the baby for the hospital, the child, realizing for the first time how helpless and weak his parents can be after all, talked to Allah in a few stuttering words of his language. He felt less anxious after that. He would, however, not let his parents know about this secret monologue, because children do not talk to Allah. What normally the child sees at home as a familiar scene, perhaps almost daily, is of the parents individually reciting what they call dua, and that too in the language which the child knows as not theirs. He does not know the reason for this recitation in a language not understood, except that it is no different from what he sees as salah, daily prayers, in regularity. He, however, notices the parents also talk to Allah. The parents' apparent secrecy of such talking in low whispers is beyond his comprehension. Call on your Lord humbly and secretly. 755. He thinks that the whole participation in this secretive monologue is for adults only. Family is the loser. Parents may falsely presume that children do understand why parents recite dua or address it in low whispers, and that children also understand that their needs are provided because of the blessing of Allah to the parents through duas. They also presume, again falsely, that children's duas to Allah, if they are made to address, produce no results because of their age. By such a presumption, the family is the loser. We mortals are poor in the sight of Allah. O men! You are, fukara, they who stand in need of Allah. 35:15. The only thing we own is the means of dua. Allah has asked us to call upon Him and promised grant of duas. I answer the prayer of the supplicant when he calls on me, 2-186. Call upon me and I will answer you. 40:60. He is the best of promise keepers. We can expect the pleas of the children to be more readily granted, not only because of their innocence, ismat, but also because teaching them to turn to Allah is pleasing to Him. Street beggars apply the salesmanship of taking out their children together to elicit sympathy. We should get our children to join us in expressing our humbleness to our Lord in the form of dua. Let us remember that if the sight of a child sitting in a quiet corner and engaged in imploring Allah in low and shy whispers with small hands raised up together moves the heart of the mother, then it is reported that the love of Allah for His creatures is 70 times of that of the mother for her child. It is simple. Parents should make the best of the opportunities presented in the form of dua when they have small children in the family to facilitate the dua to be answered sooner. It is simple. When the child eagerly requests for a special thing, not common in his wants, direct him to address a dua to Allah for it, without revealing whether the intention is to buy it for him or not, and then leave him in suspense while he keeps repeating the daily dua before the request is met. The parents should also teach the child to re-sign to the dua not being granted by making the child to address dua even where the intention is not to comply with his request. Dua is a gist of ibadat, worship, the best prayer. Ibadah versus is dua a hadith of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, and his progeny. Why not get children to participate in this form of ibadat, which is simple in performance and convenient, in the discretion of time and yet tremendously rewarding? Parents should experience the thrill on seeing their small child praying to Allah for lots of things, big and small, for them while they strain their ears to catch His words without letting Him know. For He will have been taught to pray for them also, as for Himself, in His own language. So let the child play adult in this euphoric role of talking to Allah, and the score will be real. Chapter 13. The child let sulking ceases sulking. The answer from the parents was negative when the adolescent daughter asked for permission to attend a late-night party of girlfriends the following day. And yet a couple of her friends came in time to pick her up. Smartly dressed for the party, the daughter departs oblivious to the decision and displeasure of the parents. The daughter had already registered with the parents a catalogue of such examples previously, some even more worrisome to them. In fact, seeking permission and then doing exactly what she intended to do regardless whether permission was given or not, was the daughter's dutiful way of only informing the parents, so that they were aware. It was the parents, that is, mostly the father, often supported by the mother, who graduated their daughter to this irreversible status of freedom in her relation with them. However, the graduation came about gradually in phases as the daughter grew up from childhood. The doors to graduation. There was the primary phase, to start with, which then inevitably opened the doors to the two subsequent phases leading to the graduation. The parents would more often than not decline permission to the daughter unfairly as a tradition when she was a child because they felt no was rightly safer than safely right. However, as the refusal was unfair but always pops out first as a tradition in the family, there would rightly be a reversal later to please not only the daughter but also the parents themselves. Perhaps the parents enjoyed the feel of authority over the daughter, or reversal of refusal was their way of impressing her about their love for her. Whatever the case, the consequences that ensue stage by stage become irreversible. They include a long-term disturbance in the mental and physical health of the parents. There followed another phase, as the daughter got to know the weakness of fickleness, wavering, of the parents. She would argue, sulk or cry until the answer is reversed to okay, yes, dear, where the parents should have remained firm with the original refusal. Such a successful exploitation of the parents' love was more a rule of the game than exception for the daughter. With it, her choices for which the initial permission was negative became bolder and bolder. What is worse, the siblings too tended to follow her behavior. Resoundingly and resolutely. The best love and affection for the child, since her early childhood, lies in the parents saying no resoundingly and remaining firm with it resolutely, provided however where such an answer is absolutely prudent or fair and the child is explained fully the reason for it. The child may show anger and sulk temporarily but will have permanently more respect for the authority of the parents. So instead of coming up with a quick initial or cursory negative answer to every request for permission in the beginning only to be reversed later, the parents must give an earnest thought to the child's request. They may even take time and then come up with a firm and final decision, which is fair, and this may turn out to be rightly in favor or against the wishes of the child. Unfortunately, this is not the case with a number of families, and on many occasions the long-term and far-reaching consequences are disastrous. The daughter who has been conditioned by her own parents into exercising such a freedom in open disobedience to the parents tends to continue with the freedom after her marriage and runs the risk of the breakup of her marriage even before its first anniversary. When the parents let the awe and respect of the child for them to erode, the most likely result is the frustration of most of the aspirations of the parents regarding his or her education, career, religious commitment, family attachment or good conduct in the society, and also his or her matrimonial happiness. If only the parents would tell the child the truth, that this world is not as warm, rosy and saintly as it seems to the child while he or she is under the care and protection of the parents, that this world is not needless of precautions against dangers which lurk him in every corner, and that refusal of permission where prudent and kept firm is a part of that very care and concern which in turn makes the child feel this world safe and secured. Chapter 14. Gaining Vision from Family History. A client brought his prospective, intended, partner to my office for a cursory, initial, appraisal of a proposal for a construction of a modern office building which he intended to finance with an option of a joint ownership on completion. When the prospective partner introduced himself, I got curious because of his surname. I asked whether he was related to a person of his community with the same surname with whom I was very close until he emigrated. He confirmed that he was, whereupon I naturally inquired more about their relationship. The client was surprised to find that I knew the history of the grandfather of the prospective partner, which I had learned from the emigrant cousin. The prospective partner was almost a stranger to his own family history of struggle, setbacks through mistakes and bad luck, and the later successes through patience and faith. Later the client informed me that his interest in the proposal diminished following the accidental appraisal of the person he intended to work with in the proposal. He realized that, as in the case of the proposal, an appraisal of the person intended to be involved in a proposal was equally important. The ignorance of one's own family history was seen a demerit. Lessons for Right Vision. Almost every family has a known history of tact, hardship, perseverance, devotion, and of adherence to principles, values and faith in the course of the constant struggle in life with an alternation of setbacks and successes. The known history may span over three preceding generations or more. Every young member in the family has the right to be informed of such history of the family by the parents so that he later in life as a responsible adult is able to draw lessons from it and formulate his vision aright. There may have occurred partnership disputes, business split, divorce cases, inheritance disputes, losses from business speculation and such other situations in the past in the family through perhaps negative emotions or miscalculated reasoning or misplaced trust with some disastrous consequences. Family history, if known, can help the succeeding generations avoid a repetition of the occurrences or exercise caution to avert such potential situations. But before a child is old enough for information about the family history, he has yet a prior right, equally important, a right to that best and pertinent piece of education which originates only in his home and can avail to him in his young age only by the parents. That piece is about the reality of this transient life, the life of a constant struggle, exacting mental, physical and emotional toll, until there comes the inevitable exit in the form of death. He may not know that the struggle begins right from birth. He too cried as he struggled for first few initial breath, which is normal for all babies when they are born. Importance in timing. The importance lies in timing the imparting of that piece of education for good effect. The time is when the child is getting inquisitive about the reasons for the quarrels and disputes which he hears about or witnesses as each occurs among the adults. The reasons are mostly connected with the struggle as part of this mortal life attendant with human weaknesses. He cannot be explained reasons without allowing him the perception of the constant struggle in the life of every mortal, whatever his station of life, and which is attached to every family. To preserve health is also an ongoing struggle until there is a succumb to natural death. The child has to be impressed that there is always a twist and turn in the struggle, and ups and downs in the history of every family, and that the family in which he is born is no exception. Examples of the struggle are given to the child in the form of piecemeal's narration of the family history as and when appropriate occasions arise as he keeps growing up. Then the child, on his part as an adult later would, for the information of his children, add the narration of his own life history of strife and successes as a continuous process of passing on the family history to the succeeding generations. The grasping power of a grown-up child with regard to the family history and the lessons intended for him in the narration should not be underestimated. Tribute to the grandfather. Family either late, or from other elders of the local community. They wished they had heard it earlier and from the family so that they could not only have paid tribute to the grandfather while he was still alive but perhaps also asked him for details and the reminiscence of emotions involved. Allah, the most glorified, the most high, mentions in the Holy Quran the importance of history. It offers guidance and lessons so that the reality of life is known and the mistakes committed avoided. The family history is no different. The following are the examples of the Quranic verses. And all we relate to you, the Prophet Muhammad peace be upon him and his progeny, of the accounts of the apostles is to strengthen your heart therewith, 11:120. In their histories there is certainly a lesson for men of understanding. 12:111. Thus do we relate to you, O our Messenger Muhammad peace be upon him and his progeny, of the historic accounts of what has passed of old, and indeed have we given to you from ourselves a reminder. Quran 20:99. Let us learn from the desert ant which crawls long distances under the scorching sun. It stops and turns itself to look behind now and then in order to be able to monitor the direction and forge ahead. It never gets lost. We too need to look back into the family history, that is, if we have been made aware of it in good time, as we march on with the time with no repetition of past family mistakes. Chapter 15. School enrollment with a springboard. A frustrated parent asked, how can he make his child to like the school? And the answer was, make him to like his studies, and then the supplementary question was, How to make him to like his studies? The answer to that was, make him to like his school. What comes first? There was a child, recently enrolled in a school for the first time in his life, who refused to believe that apart from a regular weekend holiday, his school could be closed for any weekday sometimes. He insisted that his mother dresses him, as usual, for the school on that day too, which he was told was a national public holiday. However, he calmed down after his tearful pleading had failed. He liked the school because he was good in his studies and the school was the place he could show himself off and bask in pride in front of other children in the class. If the child's hand was not the only one raised on any occasion when a teacher asked questions, then his would be the only one which popped up faster for fear of other possible competing hands. He knew almost all the answers to the point of virtually proving himself a nuisance to the teacher, naturally. The teacher wanted to see other students too have the self-confidence of volunteering answers as a reflection of his effective broad-based teaching in his class. There was, however, nothing miraculous about the child, who was the only one then, in the family. A few weeks prior to the anticipated enrollment of the child, the mother would regularly teach him in progressive stages exactly what he would be taught later in the school. It was from a simple basic syllabus known almost to all parents. The child too was enthusiastic because he thought that learning from the mother would qualify him for entry in the school. It would be fun for him to accompany the child next door, already a student and a friend, to the school. Magic wand. Now, a few prior and simple lessons at home before enrollment, and a continuation of some more prior lessons after the enrollment, was the magic wand that created a springboard for the child, and there was no looking back after that. Once a liking for the school is triggered, it produces good results in the studies, and then one sustains the other in a healthy cycle throughout the schooling life, leading, for many, to a university graduation. The key is to appreciate the child's natural sense of a positive competition and rivalry among the children in the class, progressing in stages, each giving way to the next as follows. Stage 1. On the day of enrollment and also for a day or two thereafter, the child brings to the school his toy, the one he likes best, thinking his is the only one that exists, often without the knowledge of his parents. He proudly reveals its presence to some of the classmates, many of whom do almost the same with regard to theirs, in competition. This stage passes to usher stage 2. Stage 2. Toys lose their relevance when the child finds older students come to the school with books and pens. He now brings to the school books and pencils, all right, but with flashy and colorful in appearance for a show-off in competition with those brought by other children. Alphabets and figures. Stage 3. Subsequently, the lessons start in earnest, beginning with paintings of pictures and writings of alphabets and figures. Now the competition spills over into what is written, or scribbled, in the exercise books and painted, or soiled, in the drawing books by the students. Here the child who had the advantage of prior lessons at home is surprised and impressed to find that he knows to do his work in the class quicker and better than other students. He attributes his competing ability as independently his own, which presumption is healthy as it sharpens his sense of competition. This is the springboard which has its effect and relevance, only if created, before the child begins his schooling life. This springboard is simple to create for each and every child in the family so that the child reports at the school equipped with it to commence his schooling life. It has been done successfully by others whose children have been obtaining top ranks successively in every grade. There have to be initiatives and personal pain on the part of the parents for sowing the seed of interest in the child about his studies before his enrollment. The seed so timely sowed will then germinate on its own and bloom into a flower with an unending fragrance throughout his schooling life. Such is the parental influence and impact on the child. No school, however good, can ever provide a substitute for this brand of a springboard.